And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. My special guest today is Hubert Petschke. He has written a book called Memoirs from the Turbulent Years and Beyond. It's an analysis and consequences of World War II. Mr. Petschke, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you to have me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Give us a little bit of your personal history. I know you cover a lot of it in the book, but talk to me about where you were born and give us a little bit of the Petschke family history.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was born in Poland on June 22nd, 1933. My father and mother, they were married before that. They already have two children. I was the third one. And at the time when I was born, Europe and Poland over there was basically recovering already from the Great Depression. And in regard to my father, he was quite active. We were living over there. He was living in the part of Poland which was occupied by the Germany. So he was called to the German army when he was only 17. And he was in the front fighting over there in German army, the French. But then he got wounded and he got back, you know. And then when he finally recovered from this in a point, then he decided, his father told him, my grandfather, to basically desert from the army and didn't go back to the front and went over there to the south Poland, and that's what he did. And he got, after volunteer to the army, new Polish army, which was already forming, and he was fighting after in this Polish army, so-called legions. And because in 1918, finally, came war ended, but for Poland the war did not end it because still, you know, were remnants of the German and Austrian armies over there, and they were basically retreating. But it was another partner now came to the fight, which was the Communist Soviet Union, because of the revolution over there. The Lenin said that Poland has the right to be independent country, but on the other hand, they didn't want to give us back the land which was before Polish, because Poland was at this time partitioned and under the three powers of Germany and Austro-Hungarian Empire and Russia. So when the war ended, this first war, then of course the Poland was officially got independence, but you still have to fight for this because nobody wants to move out. Eventually, the German armies and the Austro-Hungarian, they completely left the Poland. So the only fight was with the Bolsheviks, the communist Russia, which was born in 1917. And all this fight was going for still about two more years. And they were basically on the outskirts, on the eastern part, southeastern part of Poland, on the previously, you know, territories of Poland, and that's what basically it was. But then the Russians decided to attack Poland in 1920. That was basically the communist first expansionist war against so-called capitalist countries, and they attacked Poland. Well, unfortunately for them, unfortunately for Poland, they really lost the fight at Warsaw and was forced to retreat, and then signed the peace treaty in Riga, Latvia, and that basically ended all the fighting, and Poland started recovering from this. So, yeah, that's basically, and my father was participating in all these fights up to the end. So what then he came back, and life started slowly returning to normal in Poland, and of course everybody was rebuilding their lives, and already in 33, when I was born, was basically fairly, normal situation. And then, of course, the war came in 1939, and then, of course, was another very difficult situation because Germans attacked Poland, that was on the September 1st, 1939, and then 16 days later, the Stalin, according to the agreement with Hitler, attacked from the east, and they split the Poland in two parts. Stalin took the east part, and Hitler took the west part. So that's basically is the small background. So, and of course, during the war, when war started, I was 6 years. When war ended, I was 12. So this was definitely part of my life. I remembered a lot of things from the war, and some were, fairly normal, but some were really very difficult. So that basically is the little history up to about the war, the family. Then later in 43, my youngest sister was born, so the father and mother, they have four children.
I know that I may be misinterpreting this, but you don't seem to be a big fan of FDR.
No, and I think that, I think that that is, in a sense, justifiable because, when war finally, the World War II was ending, then definitely people in Poland who were fighting, with Germans during the war, in underground army. My father was in underground army too. He was not directly fighting, but still, involved very much so. And everybody was expecting, basically, in Poland, that after the war ended, we will be finally free and can start rebuilding the country. Unfortunately, didn't happen. And did not happen because at Yalta, and before even Yalta, in Tehran, FDR agreed to give Stalin the eastern part of Poland. So that definitely was very, very troubling to a lot of people in Poland. And, of course, the devastation in Poland was horrible after the war ended. So everybody was very, very perplexed how this could happen, that we lost all this land over there, which was previously Polish, and not only that, but also the people. And so many people during the war were basically by the Soviets over there, when the Soviets took over the eastern part of Poland in 1939, they were basically almost like butchered or sent to the Siberian gulags. So definitely this was pretty bad news for everybody in Poland, that we basically were sold, to Stalin. Why this happened? So of course this was very serious, and of course after the war ended, the Soviets took over and came and took over, basically established a new communist government. Everybody starts doing their things to get somehow life forward and rebuild. But for me, for a while already was a question, why this happened? What's happened? Well, the life goes on, and you have to go and educate yourself and go to college, everything. And finally, when I came to the United States in 1969, on beginning also, I have to hear somehow, you know, get involved and learn the language and everything, and to be part of the society and to have a chance to advance and build my own life. But as I grew more and more older, in a sense, this question starts coming back. Why this happened? Because nothing happened by itself. So what was the reason? And then I start studying really as deep as I can for all the reasons why this happened. Why this happened that not only Poland, but also Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Romania, and Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and the eastern part of Germany, well, that's, you know, they took control, and why this happened. And so, and the more I study looking and reviewing different materials, I find out that really those things should never happen, but happened because, only because of FDR. FDR, unfortunately, his history of his presidency was probably the worst ever which could happen to our country. He did so much damage that is unparalleled to any other presidency. And why this is? Because from everything what I find out is because he was basically a communist. He was a communist ideologue. And that is very, very bad because of this. That's inspired him, in a sense, to do a lot of things which never should be done in this country. Like, for example, when he just became president in 1933, elected in 1932, in March, a lot of people just when they finally he was getting to start his presidency, a lot of people was curious how this everything will go, because his idea were not really of the with in a sense similar to the majority of the people. Well, of course, economically, United States was in very difficult situation because of the Great Depression, which started in 1929. And of course, he was elected after the Woodrow. The president who lost with him because people just want to change, in a sense. Well, then they got the change, and the economy was really in bad shape, everything. So he came with this idea of his New Deal. He got the advisors, everybody, and all these advisors and himself, they were steering the country basically towards the socialism. New Deal was basically a part of the transformation from the capitalistic to the socialistic run economy. And they were forcing a lot of things on the people, and Great Depression didn't stop. Great Depression was continuing, and then during the presidency of FDR was three recessions during the Depression, 1934, 37, 39. So economically, the country was ruined in a sense. You know, of course, the dynamism of the capitalistic system still was, in a sense, prevailing. That means that people still, unemployment was high, but about 25%, which is extremely high, but we are not much lower now officially is 91, but unofficially is about 20% if you count everybody who is looking for work. So we're coming to this point that is pretty close, but that was one part of the situation, the economic part that he was dealing with. FDR, all his ideas, his policies, were basically prolonging the Great Depression. The United States never got out of the Great Depression until the World War II started, 41. So from 29 to 41, and everything was just because of the policies of FDR, who were totally contrary to the interests of the United States, and economy was not progressing at all. And that have also dramatic impact on the future to even the World War II, because if United States at this time will be economically strong and the Depression will end it, then probably a lot of things will totally change in the international relations, and also which probably might even not be a second war, because our weakness of the United States was one of the reasons that a lot of this different dictators that's coming to power. Of course, Stalin was already in.
Or like Rahm Emanuel likes to say, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Absolutely. That's what exactly what he was doing. That's what was Roosevelt doing, FDR, and exactly what is doing now also Obama. So, yeah, they're doing. All socialists and communists have similar ideas because they all basing on Marxism and Leninism, you know, and that's what it is. The same was Alinsky was also basing his rules on Lenin's rules. So, yeah, they are similar. But, yeah, so he definitely was using this. But that was the part of the economics. But then when finally United States, of course, you know, when came the year 1941 and the Pearl Harbor happened, which was extremely tragic, but unfortunately was because of the FDR. He was really the only person responsible for this attack. Why I'm saying this, and that might be to some people strange, but it is true. It is absolutely true because he was trying, FDR, get to the war. Why he was trying to get to the war? Because in 1941, on June 22nd, Germans, Hitler's army, attacked Soviet Union. Well, that was for all the communists in the United States and worldwide, the international communist movement, which I was calling international communist banditry, they were trying to save now the Soviet Union because they were attacked. And so now was called to arms how to save the Soviet Union. And, of course, for FDR, that was also the call to action. He had to do something to save the Soviet Union. That was incomprehensible for them to even imagine that the motherland of the communists will be destroyed by Germans. Of course, on the other hand, if you look from perspective historical, basically when the Germans attacked Poland from the west and the Stalin attacked from the east to basically split the Poland in two, divide the loot, and then plunder the country, that was fine and nobody protested about this. But now when the Germans, who finally who decided to attack, then everything was totally wrong. Of course, you can look at this way, but on the other hand, you have to remember that Soviet Union was trying very desperately to avoid this because Molotov went to Berlin just before, you know, the war started, a few weeks really before that, and appealing to Hitler to make the deal and split the Europe and the Middle East. That's basically what it was about. And there are documents about this. And Hitler did not agree because Stalin wants too much of Europe for himself. Well, that was, you know, two bandits that you couldn't agree how to do and split the rest. You know, so, when they were attacked, and of course the FDR was now trying to help Stalin. How in this whole thing? Of course, on the other hand, without this help from the United States, they never will be able to really. The Soviet Union never will be able to win the war with Germany or even survive for too long period of time. So when FDR decided that they have to, that the United States must help Soviet Union, then, of course, how to do it technically, that's why the Lend-Lease program start, and under this they start supplying slowly because building the war machine and starting to supplying the war materials to the Soviet Union, United States. That cost, of course, American taxpayers a lot of money, which never was recovered because they never paid the Soviets. And that's basically what started the building the power of the Soviet Union, because militarily they were not so great, and the Germans' war machine was really superior in a sense. And for first 18 months, they couldn't really too much do. But as the time progressed, they got more and more weaponry and different weapons from the United States and help in many ways economically too, and food and everything. That's that slowly building their strength and their, in a sense, their all equipment improving and building. And so that's definitely helped them enormously. Then, of course, when the war was progressing, we got more and more into this. The question was that definitely FDR wants to get involved militarily in Europe, but how to get into this? Because Congress was not eager really to do anything. Nothing happened. We still were neutral. We are not participating in anything. So then, of course, Churchill was also pressing, you know, FDR to get involved in Europe, and eventually we got, but how? That's why the Pearl Harbor was, in a sense, made to happen, because we started basically struggling. The Japan, that was the key, because this was basically the most easy way to start the war. So we were setting up Japan to make the first move and attack.
Okay, how did we do that? How did we do that? Because I want to make sure we understand this. You're not suggesting that there was a conspiracy between FDR and Japan, and FDR asked Japan to bomb Pearl Harbor. I mean, so how did FDR lure Japan into attacking us?
That's right. Yeah, that was only, he lured only Japan to attack us, because, no, that wasn't a conspiracy in the sense that was some agreement. Absolutely not. What he was doing, he was firstly cutting supply of the oil to the Japan, and Japan was very depending on the oil, their oil industry, because they were manufacturing a lot of things, and that's what they lived from. So he starts struggling economically in Japan, and that's what was doing, and he was doing more and more, and Japan became a little desperate. Then, to, in a sense, really lure even more. In Pearl Harbor, he decided that the fleet should stay in Pearl Harbor, and Admiral, he said, Richardson, I think, was the admiral, he warned really Roosevelt that this is danger because Japanese could strike over there. Well, he said no, and then they had conversation, and he fired Admiral and replaced him with Admiral Himmel, I think, and then still left the fleet over there, just dangling the fleet and waiting what will happen, and pressing more, the economic different kind of restrictions, and cutting completely the oil from Japan. So that's really...
Hubert, could you share with us a few more of those economic restrictions in addition to oil?
Yeah, there were also on the textile, and also on the textile, and that was basically the textile, and some others also. I don't remember exactly, but textile was very, very crucial too. So basically trying to completely cut off all the economic ties which we have. And then even the ambassador of Japan was warning his government that we have a problem because looks like maybe he wants to attack. He's looking for some war, and then he was asking also the premier of Japan was asking if he can have the meeting with FDR, and FDR refused. And eventually, when this everything didn't work out, then happened finally this attack. And FDR knew that they will attack because they were reading their cables. We have this facsimile to read them. So FDR know exactly when the attack will happen, almost to the hour, but didn't do anything to prevent this, the attack happened. And then when the attack happened, well, almost 3,000 Americans were killed. And that was exactly what happened because of FDR, who basically lured the Japanese, and after, of course, the attack, the next day almost the Congress decided that the war was against Japan and also against the Germans, and that's how we got into the war.
Let me ask you. If I can bring us up to some current events or a current event, when you came here to take advantage of our capitalistic system, and I know that you have success as an engineer, in your personal life, that's been your career. But I'd like to know, when you see the Occupy Wall Street people and the Occupy Oakland people and the Occupy Philadelphia people, and they're holding up these signs that say capitalism doesn't work, all of them are essentially socialist or communist, even though they have no idea what it would be like to live under a communist system the way you did in Poland. So if for any of those people who might be listening, share with them what it's like to live under communist rule and give them a taste. There's an old saying, be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. Let them know what life might be like for them if they get their wish.
Well, that's exactly, A lot of these people definitely have no idea what the socialism is. and communist socialist. Okay. So, yeah, so definitely from my experience over there, it's total control of the communist system, the totalitarian system, which means that everything, every aspect of your life is basically determined by the communist party. So if you over there protesting, that is one part, but you won't be able to protest. You will just work, and you have to do, you become a slave. If that's what you like it, that's what you will get it. Of course, we as a people will not like this, and we never should even think about this. This is the most ludicrous idea. It's, in a sense, a remnant of the 60s, maybe in 70s. All these revolutionaries who were before leading, now some of them even can see on this, of the faces, you know, of this Occupy Wall Street in different places, and some are older, you know. Of course, now they're getting also a lot of help from the also unions, but even unions don't realize what is communist, because in communist you won't have the unions. No, the unions are the arm of the party, and if party don't like it, all the unions' bosses are basically exterminated or send it to the concentration camps, and is over. So nobody have anything to say except the party. Party rules, and bosses of the party are the new gods, and that is it. If you don't like it, you are gone. So, exactly. So the people who are protesting over there, they don't have any idea what they're thinking, what they're doing. They better get and start working, go to work and look for something, and don't play these stupid games, because it's going nowhere and it's not good for them and it's not good for the country. And eventually, if I hope never happen, but if the communists will really be implemented like Obama wants, and all his helpers, advisors, and all these gangs over there in the White House, and the Democratic Socialist Party, then you will really have oligarchy, the communist oligarchy will rule, and you will be nothing, and you won't have any rights whatsoever. Because when we live over there in Poland, if you talk too much or said some things which the government don't like, and some, you know, snitches over there hear this, and they pass this, you was called to either police over there, and they have a talk with you, and if they feel that you really are maybe danger, which usually, you know, or is inconvenient, then you were sent to the labor camp. That was it. And then they train you in labor camp. You will never protest about anything. Yeah, they will beat you, they will torture you. You was nothing. You have no rights whatsoever. Remember this, guys. So you better get out and get to real world and to work, because this system is the most vicious, animalistic, and barbaric system of government. It's nothing ever worse. And also, economically, you will have nothing. Everybody will have nothing. The rich will be poor, but the poor will be still poor, except that everybody will be equal. Nobody will have anything. And the only thing, and also, no communist country under communist government ever achieved any economic prosperity to their people, because that is not the goal. The goal is to control the people and have total power over them. New rights, you have no rights. And Constitution, which they write finally, they write the Constitution, was meaningless, because the courts over there are basically kangaroo courts, and whatever party decides, the courts is doing. So all of you guys who are protesting, you better keep this in mind, and don't get hooked on this, because you will really learn what is communism, and then you will cry, but nobody will save you. So that is basically what I would like to pass to you. And remember that their torturing is unprecedented. The communists even surpassed the Germans SS in their, you know, interrogation and tortures. They were the worst. So
for Americans who think that waterboarding is bad,
waterboarding, that was nothing. That was nothing. Over there, waterboarding, nobody even will talk about this. They just put you and start torturing you, breaking your fingers, breaking your hands, legs, you know, beating you for hours, you know, then slapping you with the water and then beating you again. So, yeah, those things are normal. That's what is in communism. That's what is communism about. They have to break you. They even have this, the KGB and in Poland, the security forces, they have also even the psychological program, which was called to break you completely and make you their basically spy after. And this was so intense that people, that usually took about them about 9 to 15 months to get you ready, in a sense. And they were sending these people even out of the country, and they were doing exactly what they want. They were basically programmed because they know that if you don't do it, they will do the same again to you. So, yeah, you better get to work, occupiers, because you really don't know what you're doing. You have no idea.
They don't, and I actually saw one of them, Mr. Pechke, one of them holding up a sign that says, "Get government out of our lives." I think they have no idea under socialism and communism just how much the government would be in their lives.
Yep, would be totally in their lives, totally.
You touch on some current themes in the final chapters of your book.
Right.
For example, let's talk about the United Nations and whether or not why it was founded and whether or not you think the United States should continue to fund it and participate in it.
Well, the United Nations was founded basically was about 2 years process of 1943 to 1945. Finally, in 1945 was officially started. Who was originally working and organizing the United Nations was a State Department official called Alger Hiss, who was a spy for the Communist Soviet Union and working in the State Department like many others, because during the FDR administration, most of these people, communists, were thousands and thousands of communists working for the administration. And this man, Alger Hiss, who was Stalin, personal spy of Stalin, was organizing the United Nations. So you can imagine that under his leadership, all the first, 600 people who were hired was mostly communists or communist sympathizers, because during the FDR administration, the Communist Party was very free hand and very helpful, basically, approach from the administration. And because of this, a lot of them were, and the growth of the Communist Party in the United States during the FDR administration was the highest ever, because by close to the end of the war in 1945, the membership of the Communist Party was a little bit over 1 million people. Members. So anyway, and Alger Hiss was organizing this. So imagine all the background, all the original, the beginning of the United Nations was Communist Party members. And then Roosevelt imagined that United Nations will be the organization through which he and Stalin will police the world. Well, when Stalin heard about this whole United Nations preparation, and of course he knows how many communists were there, he liked this idea, and that's how this was basically born, the United Nations. United Nations, in my opinion, is absolutely, it's corrupted to the bottom, run by the socialists and communists, you know, and also different dictators. The organization to the bottom, bankrupt, not bankrupt, but bankrupt.
Morally what? Bankrupt? Perhaps, yeah. Morally bankrupt?
Morally, totally morally bankrupt, totally bankrupt in every aspect. And in my opinion, the United States should withdraw from the United Nations. We have no business to be over there, and no financing, withdraw. Break all the treaties which we have with them, like this, you know, they try to get us into this Kyoto Agreement, which is idiotic, you know, because of man-made global warming, which is a hoax. But they're pushing this idea because they want more money, financing, more money and all this. We absolutely should withdraw from the United Nations. We have no business to be with this, in a sense, have criminals. Besides this, the one aspect also is that the United Nations is in many ways behind this New World Order. They like this idea because, you know, bureaucrats, government, and will be now worldwide, my gosh, you know, how much money and everything, how luxury from this coming. So, yeah, we have this United Nations is not the organization which we should be associated with. And besides this, we'll save money and a lot of these programs based spreading socialism. That's what is one of the key ideas of all this socialism in different form. And
one of the problems with regard to FDR is that the American history books paint him as a hero, even though most economists who know what they're doing will tell you his policies didn't pull us out of the Great Depression. They extended the Great Depression. In American history books that are used in the classrooms, he's hailed as a hero, a genius, and of course that's because, you know, the liberals have taken over the school system the same way they've taken over the courts. You talk in your book about how to make the American school systems more efficient. Tell my listeners what you would do to overhaul the American education system.
Yeah, basically to overhaul the system, which is really in deep trouble because it's very costly and is not really providing the good education for the children. Quite often they finishing even high school and they cannot read and write properly. You know, I can tell you from my own experience being an immigrant that is a difficult to learn, and I came when I was 36, but nevertheless, I learned as good as I can, and still I can do much better, but nevertheless, it has to be done. And now the education department is run by bureaucrats, but not only that, it's run by basically the unions, and unions here are the critical part to solve this educational system. Firstly, in my opinion, the education, the Department of Education should be abolished, and all this should be ceded to the states. States should have the responsibility in regard to the education, but you will never achieve any large progress in education until the monopoly of the union is eliminated from the education. Because what this really is, that the educators or the teachers, they belongs to union, and what they're doing basically indoctrinating your children. And that's what now is in the schools, is most indoctrination in many different ways. Even the political correctness getting to the schools now. That is unbelievable. And what is political correctness? It's a basic cultural Marxism. Communism. Well, you don't want your children to learn this, but that's what the children learn in the schools. So definitely the union, monopoly of the union has to be eliminated because otherwise this really will not be good. And firstly, and the worst part is the kids still don't get a good education, and it's very expensive. If you get the union monopoly out of the system, then education will cost much less,
Hubert, if I can jump in for just a second, I sent my son to a private Catholic school from kindergarten through 12th. The school that I sent him to, the cost per educating a student is 66% less than what the public school costs to educate a student. It's one third of what the public school costs per student, and 100% of these kids go on to college. They all know how to read. They all know how to write. They know history. And it's amazing to me that people on the left think that the solution to solving America's education problem is to throw more money into the system. The system doesn't need more money. It needs efficiency, and it needs to get, as you said, to get rid of the unions. That would lower the cost immediately.
Yep, exactly. That will lower the cost. And the most important also is, in my opinion, that you will get rid of the indoctrination, because the socialistic indoctrination starts in the school already, almost from the elementary, starts this slow pushing. And that was really the main goal of the unions, to spread the socialism. They just want more for what they're doing, more and more, always more. That's why, really, in my opinion, and economically too, that unions in any forms, anywhere, are not really good for the progress and sustained growth of the economy and country. You need kids to learn what is needed. You don't need any other socialistic indoctrination. And
as you said, though, you said once the party bosses once the party has used the unions to achieve their purpose, the party bosses get rid of the union bosses anyway, correct?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because they are basically useful idiots. The people who are helping them for as long as they need them, and after they don't need them, they are disposed. That's the end of this.
I had Oleg, I don't know if you know him, but I had Oleg Atbashian on a few months ago. Well, he was actually on Glenn Beck TV last night. And I got to tell you, if you're an Occupy Wall Street kid or an Occupy San Antonio kid or whatever, if you're part of the Occupy movement, the two interviews I've done in the last year and a half that all of these kids need to listen to is the interview that we're doing right now, and the interview that I did with a man named Oleg Atbashian, who lived, you know, in the Soviet Union and then came to America, because you guys know what it's like whenever you're in a system that isn't capitalistic. You understand how hard life is, how the party controls you. And I just think these kids, as you said, have no idea what they're asking for. They're useful idiots, just like the unions.
Exactly, exactly. That is exactly true. And you have to, once you go through the system once, you learn for life what this is. And you never, that's why all the immigrants who came from the communist countries are the biggest enemies of the socialism, and basically are, in a sense, in this sense, and probably in many other ways, the biggest patriots, because they just feel, they know what this is, and they don't want to see this here. That's when I look at this everything, I cannot believe that we will go to this mess and to this system, which is so cruel and barbaric, you know, that we would like to have something like this. That is incomprehensible. Their propaganda definitely is pretty good, but, you know, it's just perception. It's not a reality. The reality of the communists is horrible, because you have no rights whatsoever. You're a slave. That is it. You're a slave. If you like to be slave, well, then you go and occupy. Then you will be slave, really. So,
you talk in the book, Mr. Huber, Mr. Petschke, you talk in the book about the importance of class warfare for the communist and the socialist to achieve their goals. Of course, right now with the OWS movement, you're seeing that. I mean, you know, we're the 99%, and the bankers, the wealthy, there's anti-Semitism, the Jews, all these rich people are bad. Of course, Michael Moore's rich, but he's good. George Soros is rich, but he's good too in their eyes. But at any rate, you see these kids who are essentially buying into the class warfare. Talk to my listeners about just how important a tool class warfare is to the socialist and to the communist.
Yeah, class warfare is extremely important because splitting the society, and then everybody's going against everybody else, you know, and that is a key of the Marxism and communist ideas to establish their rules. Because once you start pushing against each other, then definitely you have the beginning of the revolution. That's what they driving this to the revolution, because you start attacking one another, and then the end result is that will come the revolution, and that's what was during the any almost of this communist revolution, especially in Soviet Union, then this class who was supposed to be rich was all they were killed, and that is it. And whoever was not killed was sent to Siberian gulags, and that eliminated right away one class, the so-called rich, who didn't help anybody, and everybody else was poor. But in the process, you know, of preparing and getting into the revolution, then definitely the class warfare is extremely good for the communists. That's what they really always promoting this, and is devastating to the country. So the class warfare is very bad, and I'm surprised, but that's exactly what is doing also Obama. Obama is spreading also not only redistribution of wealth, but also the class warfare, because they are very connected, you know, class warfare and redistribution of wealth. So definitely it is very bad, and is the beginning of the totalitarian system, because totalitarian system needed class warfare, because always is putting one another against the other. Like back home, when the Soviets came, they right away start creating the class warfare. You know, didn't work too well, but in some other countries were maybe better, but nevertheless they achieved a lot of things, because, you know, they established the class communist party rules, and once they have this established, then anybody who have any deviation from their theories or whatever, then you're gone, because you become the enemy. So the class warfare is definitely one very important tool in preparing for the revolution and antagonistic approach to everything to solve any problem. So definitely the class warfare is one of the cornerstones of the communist, preparing for the communist revolution, and is also the cornerstone of the Democratic Socialist Party. That's what there is, class warfare. But they really do not helping anybody anyway. One of the part of this also is the welfare system. That also is part of this whole thing, to preparing to have this class of people who will only receive the welfare, but really do not become integral part of the society, because nobody cares. They only care about their votes, you know, And that is it. So, yes, definitely, the class warfare, yes, it's very, very bad and should never really happen. This idea of occupiers saying that they represent the 99%, that is absolutely idiotic. They don't represent really anybody except their dreams of socialism and communism, that everybody will be even. But somebody has to work, and this is a problem. And
right.
You will not get anything free, because if that's what you have now in Europe. You know, they have socialism already in many of these countries. That's why they're getting bankrupt. If we don't, if we go the same route, we'll be bankrupt too. We're already on the road to get bankrupt, not far. So, yes, class warfare is extremely destructive to the country.
Very quickly, I'll tell you that they're about to say that we're out of time. We're not really out of time, okay? So don't worry about that. We're just going to ignore it, because we lost about 5 minutes whenever you got disconnected. So we're going to go over a little bit. So what – in fact, let's just let that – give me 1 second. Okay. One of the things that I also want to ask you, and I've been asking a lot of my guests this recently, is do you think that what's happening in America with regard to Occupy Wall Street, the flash mobs, the violence that we see happening at OWS and through the flash mobs, do you think we are headed toward major civil unrest at this point? Is it unavoidable, or do you think we can somehow manage to avoid it?
Well, that is a very good question. Excellent. And can we avoid this? Yes, I would say that yes, we're gearing into this. And I would say that this is intentionally, slowly pushed through the White House and Soros and all these people connected with this whole movement, basically towards transformation of America from capitalistic to socialistic, communistic type of government. So this Occupy Wall Street is not a phenomenon in the sense that was born from nothing. No, it's prepared and is trained in a sense, paid also. That was Soros money coming to. And can this lead to some serious, you know, situation? In my opinion, that yes, can, and that's what is here, very, you know, thin line, how we all as American will deal with this. We should try to marginalize this, because really is a margin, small margin of the society who is now involved in this, and it will be not for the media. Probably will fizzle down and be already maybe gone. So media is doing their job really fantastic to promoting, in a sense, and keeping alive this. Why also I'm saying this? Because in a sense of coming election in next year, and in the view that the popularity of Obama is dwindling, and he probably starts seeing that he cannot win election by normal process, I'm afraid that this might be also instigated further and keep alive to a point that at one point, by about probably first quarter or second quarter of next year, that will might evolve to bigger clashes, you know, and to allow Obama to institute the martial law. That is what is my worry about this. The question is how we, the people, will respond to this. That is the key. And how every other aspect of the society and our military will respond. So it is very slippery road, I would say, which Obama, I think, and his administration and all these cohorts together, how they're planning to this. It's very slippery because could work to their advantage or disadvantage. I am not sure, but definitely we could expect that this whole charade might go for some time and will depend really on the people, how they reacting to this. But I'm afraid that they're planning for something bad from this to happen, that this is basically like a preliminary. The union starts helping more in organizing this, and unions talking, some of the leaders of unions talking really about some drastic movement. So who knows how this will end it. But I hope that this will fizzle away. But I'm not sure. I think that those powers behind are not interested in eliminating or in slowing this down. And Obama's support of this, to me, that was basically like a call to arms in this group of people. So who knows how this will end it, but I hope that will end it good, but I'm not sure. And we have to be, in a sense, prepared and be alert and see. And when we really get to the election, vote, and we must win, because that is it. That is the most important election of this century, as I see it. And it's not easy. And the left is quite often unpredictable, and they trying to get as many as possible useful idiots to do their dirty job. So we'll see. I hope that will. I think that the wisdom of the American people is much greater than many politicians are really believing in. So I think that eventually everything will somehow work out and we'll get to the election process. But as I said, there's a very strong possibility that is a prelude to something worse to come.
Do you have a favorite candidate among the Republican candidates at this point?
Well, that is a good question. I tell you honestly, I'm still struggling a little bit with this, because my idea was for a long time already that we should elect the conservative person, the most conservative person. Because why? Economically, is crucial, because in my opinion, we have to go back to the fundamental doctrine of the capitalistic system, which says that the wages can fluctuate as well as the prices and supply and demand, and then we will be in great shape. And especially with the fair tax, we will be phenomenal growth. But in my candidate, I started leaning lately after those debates, you know, and how they behave and how they respond, and also trying to get more the insight. I start leaning a little bit towards Gingrich, because Kane is good, but I'm not sure if he at this time will be the best our choice. Mitt Romney, unfortunately, I like him from one hand, but I don't know if I can trust him. And, you know, economically, I don't know. He's not conservative. So, yeah, I would say that between two of them, Kane and Gingrich, but seems to me that Gingrich have much more experience, and I think that he will be handling this much steady and decisively than anybody, seems to me. So that's basically what I can say. And I don't think so. We can expect really anybody else to join, because it's too late, I think, for this. So we'll see how this will work, but I'm start leaning towards Gingrich. We'll see how this everything will work.
Now for the most important question I have to ask you.
Yes.
How can my listeners get a hold of a copy of your book?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I have the website. Can I email? I can tell you now, but I can email you also.
Well, let's do this. Go ahead and tell me, and then email it to me, and I'll post it on our website as well.
Sure. Yeah. It's www, like always, and it's Hubert Petschke, all small letters, hubertpetschke.com. my Cambridge website.com.
Very good. And for people who might not know how to spell Petschke, it's P-O-E-T-S-C-H-K-E. And Hubert, just like it sounds. But thank you for being here today, Mr. Petschke. I have enjoyed it immensely. There's nothing like hearing about communism from someone who's had to live under it. It's an important message you send. The book is very insightful. For anyone who came through their American history classes in high school and college thinking that FDR is the greatest president of all time, I suggest you read Hubert Petschke's book, Memoirs from the Turbulent Years and Beyond, and get a different perspective on President FDR. Once again, Mr. Petschke, thank you for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to having you back sometime.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.